Welcome to the Tech Talk Show, an hour of news, views, and comment. Well, welcome. Hello, Dan. It's only us in the studio today.
It is. It's a bit lonely in here,
yeah,
isn't it?
I know. Yeah. Well, I don't know where everybody's gone, but we've actually got two pre-records, which is great.
We have, yep.
And we've got two people on the phone, and we're still going to do unboxing.
I know. How are we going to pack it all in, Steve?
I really don't know, but well, I'm going to be really strict on the time management. So, straight into the news.
Straight
do you
in.
Know what I'm fed up with?
Oh, tell me all about it.
Black Friday. I'm sorry. You know, how can a car hire company have a Black Friday sale? I mean, but it will be one of the biggest tech sales days of the year.
Really?
So, yeah, I reckon most of the tech will be bought over the next sort of few days.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I did see, remember seeing a report where it actually suggests that people research online or you know, the devices they're thinking of buying, because sometimes the Black Friday sales aren't always the cheapest.
No, I've been looking at PCs though, I must admit, a new laptop, because mine is just so painfully slow. And it was with, I think, an i7, is it? That's the processor, yeah, I'm looking around that. But anyway, fantastic deals, £200-300.
Wow.
Off a reasonable, you know, mid-price laptop. So, yeah, great. I know you've got a story, so tell us what you've got.
Yeah, so this is quite interesting for those people with smart devices and are worried about battery. Scientists at the University of Central Florida have come up with a tiny capacitor, supercapacitor battery that can charge and will last for days and days without recharging. So, you know, they'd be able to, and these things are tiny. They're sort of stamp size and using nanotechnology with nanowires. And it could replace batteries in devices. You know, you're looking at where a normal lithium-ion battery can drain after 300 to 500 times. These can last up to 30,000 cycles.
Amazing. I mean, yeah. Battery tech is driving so much innovation across automotive and devices as well. It's incredible. And the recharging time is going to be a big, big issue.
I mean, these they're saying that they can, you'd be able to, with one of these supercapacitors, you could be able to recharge it in seconds and you wouldn't need to charge your phone again for over a week. So
yeah, no, great. There's a great story on Twitter. Bloke lost his phone in a lake. Sat there, iPhone 4 sat there for a year, and then they still worked afterwards.
Wow!
How did that? I dropped mine down the toilet. It didn't work forever.
I had to throw
it away.
Usually, sort of bit of breath on them there.
Yeah, they're gone. Yeah. And all that rubbish about shove it in a box with rice.
Yeah, never try it. Tastes awful, doesn't it?
I have just got one further story, which is about supersonic travel.
Ooh.
And there's a big thing on the news about a company called Boom Aeronautics, or Aero. And they are in the process of developing a supersonic jet.
Wow.
They want to create a 40-seater supersonic jet that will go from the US over to Europe in sort of just over 3 hours, flies at 1,451 miles an hour, journey time just over 3 hours, and they reckon that they can get the price down to a business classy type thing. So, yeah, amazing. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
Richard Branson is obviously involved in it as well. So, yeah.
It's nice to see a successor to Concorde, isn't it? It'd be nice to see something like that again.
Yeah, well, I saw the first Concorde fly up the Thames.
On your 50th birthday, was it?
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, weren't far off, actually. No, I was a kid and my dad took me and we watched it fly up the Thames. And it's always been a fantastic piece of technology well before its time. Too noisy, too costly, too complex.
But lovely.
And hopefully these guys at Boom will actually bring that back. So
brilliant.
Great. We are now going to go to a pre-record. And this is a guy called Chris Barnes from Sendable. And it's all about social media management. So Chris Barnes from Sendable has just joined us. Chris is on the stand, actually, right next to the radio pod. Welcome, Chris.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, great. So Sendable, more and more companies need to make sure they've got their social media presence sorted. How does Sendable help them do that?
Definitely, yes. So social media has obviously become a key part of your marketing strategy now. It's not just kind of putting adverts in magazines. You have to really know what you're doing online. The internet can be very powerful if used properly. Sendable allows you to post and schedule a variety of different messages to all of your social media with ease. So you can post directly to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or anything else you're using, as well as directly to YouTube. This saves you not only a load of time, but also allows you to generate content that's relevant to your particular niche. So you'll become a thought leader on social media.
So obviously within the marketing world, you need to profile your customer, you need to know what your key messages are. But also, is timing important when it comes to going out on social media?
Yes, of course, yeah. So you've obviously got optimum times based on the number of people who have viewed your posts in the past. Sendable will allow you to work out down to the minute what the best time to post on different platforms are, so that you're making sure that you get the best engagement really on what you're looking to post out.
And does that vary across different social media platforms?
Yes it does. So obviously people use things like Facebook at the weekends, whereas LinkedIn will be a very strong kind of 9-to-5 customer base or audience. So you really have to make a different strategy based on the different platforms.
And do, when you work with your clients, or is it solely an app that people, a piece of software that people can use?
Yeah, so anyone can come onto the sendable.com website and download a 30-day free trial. Depending on the number of social media accounts you have will depend on what account type you need. Mm-hmm. Within 30 days you'll be able to see quite easily if it suits your business. And then you can judge for yourself whether that's going to generate you more leads and more traffic.
So the key benefits of it are, one, you can look at and time your media message, but also can you replicate the message across different social media?
Yeah, so the main benefits are, one, it saves you a lot of time in managing a lot of different social media accounts, so that you don't have to keep on going into all the different social media accounts and managing them. Two, you get to build up a relevant audience. And you can market to that relevant audience. And three, you can find content that's really, really interesting to that relevant audience and share it with ease. So Sendable will find the best trending content at the moment.
So not only is it helping you get your message out, it's actually prompting and helping you to develop content, to develop what's interesting at that time.
Yes.
To make you current, I suppose.
Yes, so you can find the most up-to-date trending topics within a touch of a button and share them to your different social media channels, as well as seeing what people are saying about your brand or what people are saying about you personally.
And it's available to use across all social media?
Yeah, we still have a few platforms that are emerging in Asia that are not yet part of Sendable, but certainly all the key core Western platforms that people use are.
Yeah, and in your experience and advice, what would you say is probably the most effective social media platform at the current time? Because it really does change, doesn't it?
I'd say it depends on what kind of business you are.
Right.
If you're in e-commerce, something like Pinterest could be your most effective channel, whereas if you are a solicitor's, you're not going to ever want to use Pinterest. So, and maybe something like Twitter or LinkedIn would be better for you. So it really depends on your business type.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us. We always try and get a tip from somebody. Where do you see as the next emerging key social media platform?
So it's personalization, and I can say that without even having to think about it. Obviously at the moment you've got people sharing a lot of data and you're able to find people who are interested in your topic, but very soon you'll be able to segment your audiences based on what they're interested in. So I'd say that the top tip is try and claim a niche online and own that niche, so that you're the thought leader for that particular subject.
Great advice. And where can we get more information about Sendable?
On the website, sendable.com, we'll give you numerous advice and white papers, as well as the option to download a 30-day free trial.
Thank you very much, Chris. Cheers. So, Dan, that was sendable. And we're now joined online by Imogen Clare and Chris, who's a senior engineer at Generic Robotics. Imogen, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
And
it's
welcome
a pleasure
to the
be
show.
Here.
Yeah, no,
thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. It would be lovely to hear a little bit about Generic Robotics and what you actually do and how you've been set up. So perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the work you do.
Yes, of course. So Generic Robotics was set up by essentially a group of friends studying engineering at Reading University. There were two in particular called Tom and Ali, who are now the directors of the company. They developed in their studies a keen interest in clinical simulation.
Okay.
And so from there they kind of branched off and established Generic Robotics, which really is about applying technology to real-world problems. And we're now kind of 6 years down the road and comprise a team of scientists, engineers, developers and doctors working together to bring new forms of training
to the world. And it's about joining together VR,
haptics
and actual training packages.
To help
doctors actually go forward, is that right?
That's exactly it. So essentially what we work on is building hardware and software that trains clinical skills. So that is a combination of VR, haptics, robotics, if you like, and then e-learning packages that support the process.
So that's brilliant. Imogen, I've seen one of the videos of some of your devices working, but can you explain to some of the listeners what you mean by haptics?
Yes, definitely. So in a nutshell, haptics is the science of touch feedback. So it's the sense of touch, but more it's your physical interaction with the world. Mm-hmm. But in this case, your physical interaction with a computer device. And the emphasis is on interaction. So haptics is a two-way process, action resulting in sensation. So you touch something on a screen and it responds to your touch, or you hold, in our case, let's say a medical tool in your hand and you start to drill a tooth or inject somebody and you can actually feel textures sort of coming through that are realistic.
I mean, that must be so important for doctors to get that feedback, whether it's, chiseling out a knee joint to put a new knee in, or whether it's the feeling of the drill on the tooth or something similar like that. That is important, isn't it, to get that?
Extraordinarily important. And, currently in dental schools, the way that students are learning is either by practicing on each other, I mean not taking teeth out fortunately, but giving each other injections, or they're using plastic teeth, which are really expensive and students can get through tons in 5 minutes. So what we're trying to create is something that's actually going to endure.
So in the 6 years you've obviously been developing the range of products, did you start simply by developing something about how to feel, how to give an injection, and then you've moved on to more complex procedures or complex equipment? How has it developed?
Well, we started with working making simulations that spanned different procedures, so that includes dental drilling, giving injections, various orthopedic procedures, and then endoscopies.
Yeah.
We have specialized in dental training for now, but there are multiple kind of opportunities for expansion in the area, learning anything from how to give a lumbar puncture to how to perform a laparoscopy.
And I suppose that is just going to continue to grow with the advent of more affordable VR. How will that feed into your product design and development?
Yeah, I mean, this has kind of been the year for VR, hasn't it? In
Very
some
much
ways,
so.
It's just been an absolutely huge wave, and it has become more affordable. And we see some really top-level areas kind of capturing it as quickly as possible. You know, we know that Facebook put $26 billion into buying the Oculus Rift. And I think Mark Zuckerberg did actually say, you know, VR is going to change the way we live, work and communicate. And I think what we're really, really interested in, because obviously there's a great gaming opportunity and it's huge in entertainment, but we're very interested in a kind of more down-to-earth practical application in how it can actually improve health, people's lives, patient care, and supporting clinicians.
No, it's really good.
I think the idea of, you know, bringing it into games is quite fascinating, because at the moment, you know, what your device seems to give is that haptic feedback, that ability to have that, you know, interaction with a you know, either substance is or you know, different environment. But at the moment, the gaming sort of, you know, it's just usually a couple of sticks in people's hands that they wave around and they see, you know, on screen. So yep. Being able to have, you know, that interaction with a you know, the virtual,
I mean, it is
reality.
Virtual 4D really, yeah. Because you've got feel, sight and, you know, 3D and feel
well,
as well.
This is it, and this is something that we kind of feel very passionately about, that, you know, VR will immerse you in so far it employs your capacity for sight and sound, but there is a missing sense there, and that's the ability to touch. And to really feel the world around you. And in terms of actually making headway in improving that, you know, we think we're the missing link, one of.
I mean, Dan and I were at VR World, which was part of Apps World at Excel a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And it was really interesting to talk to a lot of the developers around VR and AR, actually, which is another huge area. And the only downside is that it's difficult to train as a team where you use VR, because everybody's with headset and earphones in, you can't interact with other people, only what's on the screen. Will that affect what you do as well? I mean, is that important to train as part of a surgical team?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think one of the things that we're wanting to develop is a way in which people can train using VR and haptics on systems that don't involve having to wait too long. So, you know, you should, for example, be able to buy a piece of our software and that will add haptics to your existing capabilities.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, that sounds a really good way. Dan, so, yeah, go on.
Yeah, sorry, we're waving at each other and I wanted to ask this question. So,
it's okay, fighting for space.
Yeah. Exactly. So you're talking a lot about training and that at the moment, and I can see that the real benefits of being able to give people a closer to real world, you know, experience. But do you foresee that this sort of technology could be used for people to say, like, a surgeon to do an operation remotely or something like that?
Well, there is that capacity, isn't there? I think that's even being done now.
You can
actually conduct surgery remotely. It's not something specifically that we're looking at. Okay. Ours is much more hands-on and intimate, I suppose, at this stage. But the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I think this is what we see with lots of tech companies and lots of whether it's medical tech or food tech, is that the companies never know where they're going to end up. They start developing and then a market opens which they never even dreamed that they would go to. So, yeah, be interesting. So where next for you? Where are you focusing your efforts? Is it still mainly dental? But I saw there was mention around veterinary as well.
Yes. Okay, so there are two things to cover there. The first is that what we're really building towards and closest to is bringing out our intraoral injection simulator.
Okay.
Intraoral meaning injection in the mouth. And this really is quite groundbreaking in that it's a novel, unique training system for teaching this particular procedure.
Where you position the exact injection as well as... force and depth, is that
exactly
right?
That
okay.
You've got it in one, so yeah, you know, if a dentist is going to give you an injection, you really want them to do it in the right place.
I don't want more than one.
Not in the eye. So the idea is that, you know, a dental student will be able to, with the help of simulation and VR and robotics, actually feel the differences in texture, as in, you know, injecting into the skin, then moving into tissue, potentially feeling bone, hopefully not, etc. Right. And from there, you can really build up the essential skills, confidence and expertise before performing it for real. Because that's the basic premise that we work from. You know, if you or a loved one were about to be operated on, you know, you'd want to be operated on by someone who had done it before.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a... there's real scope for improving that area, and that's really what we're focused on.
And I suppose the technology around the robotics, that must be a huge amount of the area that you're working on and developing. Is that right?
Yes.
Or have you taken technology from somewhere else?
No, we really, I mean, in terms of something that we've had to overcome, if you like, as a company, we've literally had to develop everything from the ground up, and that included building our own robots, because there wasn't anything on the shelf that completely suited our needs. So we designed our own motor electronics, which was literally suited to general purpose haptic use. Mm. So that provides us with the foundation then to branch out into lots of different areas, including the veterinary. So that touches on what you mentioned before.
Yeah, that's great. So what about information? Where do people go to learn more about generic robotics?
Our website is definitely the best place.
Yeah, some good video on there, actually, I have to say.
Yeah, really nice video.
Yeah, it is.
And it does bring it to life a little bit and gives it some context. And that's www.genericrobotics.com. So nice and simple.
Yep, and I assume you're on the normal Twitter and everything else, Imogen?
Yes, we are. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, we haven't had a chance to talk to Chris, so maybe we should have asked some more technical questions and we could have drawn him in. But it's been great hearing about what you're doing, and it is amazing technology,
Dan, isn't
it? It is
fantastic,
yeah. Yeah, so no.
I really recommend people to look at the website. It's
good. Yeah, I would too. I think, Imogen, it's great. And anything that helps train people correctly, but also, you know, cost effectively, I think that clearly is a key to what you're doing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it really matters. I mean, we're really seeing that there's also, you know, increasing demand for clinical simulation to be integrated into learning curriculums, similar to it being as automatic as it being in aviation.
Yes.
So that's what we're moving towards, and I think the trend is going that way.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to speak to you.
It's been a pleasure.
And good luck with everything you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye. Well, there we go, Dan.
Brilliant, wasn't it?
Do you know what time it is time for?
I think it's time for unboxing, isn't it?
It is.
Okay.
Here we go. Okay. And we're also joined by Harry. Shout out, Harry. How you doing? All right, mate.
Right.
So we've enabled Harry to have a little chat. We've got his own microphone. So
I think I'm getting on with this because...
Dan's straight into the box.
So, showing it to the camera, we've got an HD camera. Okay, so it's for an Android, which is, I've been told that my phone's been prepared for.
Only Android?
It looks like it's only Android, because otherwise...
You love a big Android. Do you know when she was talking about transplanting things? I wonder, is there any possibility you could have a brain transplant? Is that possible?
For me, they'd probably have to... use nanotechnology to find it or something.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
So with the box, inside the box is a cable with micro USB and it looks like a camera on the end.
Okay. So some sort of camera.
Speaking about medical training, it looks like a bit like an endoscope, doesn't it?
Oh, I wonder what we could do with that today.
And also in the box...
I'll move you swiftly on. An endoscope.
Yes. So it has a small CD in it, which I presume is software, and then it has a converter for the micro.
Will it fit
USB.
Up your nose?
We can. We can have a look in a second.
Okay.
Right. So it's got a light. So I plugged it in.
Right. Okay.
Looks like
it's working straight away. Actually,
it has. Yeah. So the end of the camera's lit up.
So how long do you think the cable is? Oh. So we've got a very small.
I would say it's probably a
head
meter,
on a long black. No, 2 meters.
2 meters. Yeah.
So we've got 2 meter long black cable plugs into your phone. Oh. It's got a little camera and a light on the end of it.
Yeah. And it's.
And.
Oh no. Okay. Oh.
What's the box say?
The box says
what's the name of it?
Android camera, HD camera. That's all
HD camera.
Yeah.
Okay.
Boroscope.
I'm used to you boring me, by the way.
So
that's appropriate.
So it's working at the moment. It's worked straight away with plugged into my camera. I'm gonna see what it looks like up my nose.
Have you shoved down your nose?
Yeah, look at that.
Oh, no. Hang on. Is it clean?
Yeah, it's not now, no.
Let me show that my nose.
Yeah,
then,
go on then. Okay.
Have a look at my nose.
Okay. Get it over there. Okay.
It's just going up there now.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Hairy? Is it hairy?
There's some Lego in there.
Is there? Is there anything else?
I'd like to apologise to the Periscope users as well.
Harry.
Okay, so this is...
You know where it's got to go, Harry.
This one-upmanship has to continue, Harry.
No. Dang, please keep your trousers on it, because we can't do anything else. Right.
Okay, so this is quite amazing.
What was the quality of the picture like? Because I haven't actually seen the quality of the picture.
So I'm just going
to... Let me come around to your mic and have a look.
Yeah, so it... once you keep it still, it's actually not bad. It says it's HD, but I'm not entirely sure. Oh, there we go, dentistry. But it seems like it allows you to take pictures of devices and to record it as film. And there's a number of some different settings.
Mic now. That's amazing.
Yeah, this really is pretty good. You can see that other than putting it up, your nose and in your mouth, you could use it for, if you had something, lost behind the sofa or a fridge or...
I tell you what, I think in cars, you drop a nut down the old thing or down the plug hole
I can get one of these from
waterproof?
I don't know.
Straight down the drain?
You could put it down. Oh, it is waterproof, yeah.
Really?
It's IP67. You can plug it into your to a PC as well.
But you can't direct where it goes. It's not the one
it's not. It's fully flexible sort of thing. So it would just
shove it down a hole and see where it goes sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really hard not to joke about.
It is. I'm trying to be so sensible, but it's got that sort of chuckle factor about it. Yeah, really.
So should we start guessing about how much it...
I don't even know. Harry, do you know? Harry's going to let us know.
Does Harry actually know?
What mic are you going on, Harry? Harry knows how much. Go on in.
Let's have some guesses first.
Okay. I'm going to say £8.
I think the quality of the picture, although it's not very good when it's moving, don't shove it in your eye, Dan, it'll blind you. I would have said at least £15 to £20. No, more. I'm thinking more. So, yeah.
Well, the actual answer is $9.99, and it's available from Amazon. So, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
I'm going to get one.
Well, I'm going to see if I can have this one. Give it to my brother for his birthday.
Christmas. Yeah, what a Christmas present.
Brilliant. So, what do you reckon? In the box?
Oh, mate, it's a definite. It rocks.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Undoubtedly.
Harry?
You could just endless hours
rocks.
Of fun.
Definitely
yeah.
rocks.
Yeah, endless hours of fun. Yeah, I really like that. I think that's a brilliant $9.99 well spent. What you'd use it for, I have no idea.
Practical uses is virtually zero.
But, I really like it.
It does say for things like when you drop stuff down the sink and things like that. I think that's its primary use rather than putting it up your nose, to be fair.
Is it really? Okay.
Oh, that's disappointing. Good.
Damn. Well, there Fantastic. We go, mate. Yeah. It just goes to prove we shouldn't be given small things like that that really just, not.
No.
Anyway, that's great, mate. So... Anything happening on Twitter, Harry? We're all done on that, and we're going to go to a pre-record in a sec.
Just Black Friday. You've talked about it already, but a lot of people, I think they're sick of it, especially over here. You don't really get the deals, and a lot of people are bemoaning that point that there's just no deals, really. It doesn't seem any
Also, you know, Black Friday on car hire. How does that work? Eh?
Yeah.
No. I can understand. If it's tech, yes.
In America, it's not bad. Looks like there's some good deals on PlayStation over the pond, but not over here. And people are not happy about
it. I'm with you, mate, on it, to be quite honest.
Yeah, agree.
We should have a Black Friday, Free Friday, if that makes sense.
Somewhere.
Anyway, great. I think that was a brilliant, brilliant unbox. I love that.
I think it's
a good bit of tech, yeah. Okay. Now, we are going to go to a pre-record with Neil from Eversheds. He's going to talk about copyright, trademarks, and how to protect your innovation, which I think is really good.
So I'm with Neil Mooring, and Neil is a partner in the very famous international law firm, Eversheds. He's based in the London office, and he's an expert in IP and media. We have a lot of tech companies that listen to this programme, And a lot of them sometimes get the sort of copyright, trademark, patent thing a little bit confused. So what we're going to do is talk about the differences of those and how you get hold of those. But also, I do feel that some companies are getting themselves into trouble because they're starting to use other people's IP, music clips, video clips and something, you know, whatever on websites. And actually that can get you into an awful lot of trouble as well. So let's talk about, Neil, I wonder if you could just tell me the difference between a copyright and trademark.
Yeah, thanks very much. So it's obviously absolutely key for businesses to get the ownership of their IP sorted at an early stage so that when they become successful or they look to exit or sell or attract investors, that the value is in the business. A trademark is the brand of the business. It's the mark that differentiates your business, your goods and services from those of another. It's something that you apply for in the UK and in other jurisdictions, and it gives you the right to prevent other people from using that trademark or a similar mark.
So is that your logo, is that your name, or is it both?
A trademark can actually comprise many forms. If you think about it, it's essentially whatever you can use to differentiate your business. So it might be the name, it might be the logo, it can actually be a smell, it can be a colour.
A smell? You're joking here. A colour. So I can get a trademark for a colour, like Cadbury's sort of purple or something.
That's right. So I think Heinz have got a trademark for their sort of pale blue that they use on their tins. It can be a shape, like the Toblerone shape, but obviously most traditionally a trademark will be the name and perhaps a logo.
But if I make chocolate and it's triangular, I can actually get a trademark for that, it sounds like.
Well, it's likely that you'd be infringing Toblerone's trademark. But that's the basic position for trademarks. There's a registration system in the UK and in most of the jurisdictions. And the good thing about that is that if you do register your trademark, then it's on the register. Others are on notice that you own that trademark. And that's to be distinguished with copyright. So copyright is, in to my mind, more relevant in the creative industries, but it's relevant in everything we do almost every day. And copyright protects literary, artistic, musical and dramatic works. It arises automatically as soon as something's recorded. So if I were to write something down, provided it's original, it's likely there'd be copyright in that written work. And so it's possible, if you have a logo for your business, it's possible that in addition to any trademark that you happen to have registered, you might also have copyright in that logo.
That's just because I've literally drawn it or written it myself. As soon as you do that process, it's almost automatic. You don't have to register it with anybody. I guess your problem is proving it's yours, though.
Absolutely right. So you don't have to register it with anybody, except if you happen to operate in the US, there's a system of copyright registration there. But in other major jurisdictions, it arises automatically. What some people do to prove that they created a particular work on a particular day, for example, is perhaps to post a copy of their work to themselves, unopened in an envelope, and then it's date stamped and so on, so they can prove that they created that work on that particular day. That's one way.
That's pretty smart, isn't it? So you draw it or whatever it is, and print it off, put it in an envelope, send it to yourself, registered post, presumably. Never open it, because then you can prove it, and just stick it in a drawer somewhere, and if anything ever arises, you've proven the date that you actually did it.
That's absolutely right. So you can then hopefully prove that your work predated those of perhaps a competitor.
Just costs a stamp and nothing else. I'm liking that.
And it just costs a stamp. But obviously one of the issues that you have with copyright is that there is no system of registration, and so it's not so easy for others to be on notice of your rights. So that's to be distinguished with trademarks. Also, the big difference between trademarks and copyright in terms of name and a logo is that there might be copyright in a logo. The reality is there will not be copyright in a name. And usually a business will have a logo and a name, and that's why the trademark's important, because it will be very difficult, or frankly impossible, to have copyright in the name. And so even if a competitor didn't use or copy your logo, they might seek to use a similar name, and that's where the trademark becomes invaluable, frankly.
So that's completely different. So when you're setting up a company, let's say I'm calling it, I don't know, Textiles Limited or something, I can have that at a company's house. I might be able to get a website address, you know, URL or whatever, all those sorts of things, but that in no way actually protects that name. If somebody then subsequently gets a trademark, I might not be able to use my name or my website any longer. Is that possible?
That's absolutely right. So if you don't register your trademark and you just happen to use a particular name for your business for a while, and then a competitor comes along, or not even a competitor, just a third party comes along and uses a similar name and registers that trademark, then it's likely that they will trump your prior right. So it's important to get that registration in. All I would say, though, there were two things that are very important when businesses are starting out. First of all, when choosing a name, it's very important to do your own searches. Now, you can pay. It used to be the case that clearance searches were very expensive. They're not quite so expensive now, but in reality, it's easy for somebody to do some rudimentary searches on the internet to see if other businesses are using similar names. So just do some common sense searches to see if anybody else is using a similar name. If you can't find, and look on the Intellectual Property Office website as well. If you can't find anything, then the likelihood is that you can go ahead and use that mark. The other thing I'd say is that particularly where a business is operating in multiple jurisdictions, having a trademark portfolio can become quite expensive, because trademarks and copyright, for that matter, are territorial. So you might register a trademark in the UK, but if you also operate in France and Spain and Australia, you need trademarks there. And so it's not essential that trademarks are registered as soon as a business starts out. It's worth just seeing where the business is going. But as soon as that mark begins to have some currency, you're trading under it, you're gaining some goodwill, that's when it's worth just thinking about registering the trademark.
So I can go on to the Intellectual Property Office, ipo.gov.uk, I think, website. You can look at trademarks and you can do a search, can't you? So you can put in your company name, you can then see. When I've been on there before, it's actually not that expensive to do a trademark yourself, although you probably do need some advice. But there's lots of different classifications. So let's say I am called Textiles and I want to register that as a trademark. Somebody's already registered that under biscuits or something, I don't know, whatever, confectionery. Is it still okay then to register mine under technology or whatever?
It would be okay to have, let's say, a similar mark in a different class, and the Intellectual Property Office would look at that during the application process. But you're absolutely right. Trademarks are registered for particular classes. And what the Intellectual Property Office will be concerned about is whether the trademark that you're applying for is capable of distinguishing your goods and services. So if, for example, there's a similar trademark for, as you say, biscuits, and your business is a technology business, then the likelihood is that there'll be no overlap. And actually the same questions arise on infringement. So if a third party uses a trademark, a similar trademark, or for that matter an identical trademark in an entirely different sector, then the question will be, is there a likelihood of confusion in the minds of the public?
And it is about the public then. So what the IPO are looking at is making sure a member of the public doesn't accidentally believe you're one company when you're another. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, because it goes back to the very essence of a trademark, which is to distinguish your goods from those of another. And so the idea is to ensure that the public and consumers are not misled.
So if I register a trademark, which I think is only a few hundred pounds, it's not that expensive, is it best to just get as many classifications, that, you know, these brackets of different sectors as possible?
If you have more, the more classes you have, the more you have to pay for a stop. But also, you need to see where you're going to use the trademark itself. So it's not worth registering a trademark in classes where you've no wish or no likelihood to use that trademark, because at a later date, there's always the chance that a third party will come in and try and invalidate your trademark because you've not used it in a particular class. So as I say, If you're going to use your trademark in a technology business, then register it for that business. You might, if you've got plans to expand in the near future, you might consider registering for other classes that are relevant to that expansion. But if, for example, you've no wish to expand into the confectionery or the automotive sector, then there's no point registering because you just make your mark vulnerable on at a later date.
And if I've got my trademark and I submit it, the IPO look at it to see if it's okay. They then ask, do they ask any other companies that are similar or have got a name, you know, very close to it, whether they object?
They will. They'll essentially post notices, and then usually those that the contact details for those similar marks will be contacted, and they'll be alerted to the trademark application, and then there's an opportunity then to object. And the same is true if you own a trademark and a third party is seeking to register an identical or similar mark, then you would ordinarily receive a notice to inform you, and then you'd have a particular period in which to register an opposition. And actually, even if you don't register that opposition or send in that opposition, it's still open to you to seek to invalidate that mark after it's been registered. So you actually get two bites at the cherry.
And all in all, I've dealt with the IPO. They're pretty efficient, actually, and it's quite a streamlined process. So once you do all that stuff, it could be within 4 or 5 months, if there's no objections and it's all okay, that by then you've got a trademark, which has cost you a few hundred pounds.
Yeah, absolutely right. So you're absolutely right. The UK IPO is efficient. It will be a few months, and hopefully with no oppositions, it will all go through very smoothly. And the other good thing is worth saying about the IPO is that they've expanded their website in recent times, and there's lots of good know-how on the IPO website as well, just basic stuff about how to apply for a trademark, what a trademark does, what copyright does. So there's some basic information, and there are various briefing notes to guide people through the process. So it is relatively easy to track through.
So it's quite clear, but obviously if it's a little bit complicated or a little bit daunted, or you 100% want to get it right, you do need to go to a lawyer's or IP specialist and get them to help you.
Yeah, that's right. You would either go to a law firm or trademark attorney, for example, who specialise in portfolio management and registering trademarks.
So definitely get that trademark, without a doubt. Your copyright might be in place automatically, so maybe not worry about that too much, but you might have to prove when you made that mark. Very, very quickly, in terms of software and writing code, applying for a patent isn't simple, and applying for a patent is actually a bit of a nightmare and expensive. What do you think about applying for a patent if you are writing code or you've got an app? Or is it really worth it because it takes so long? The technology's then moved on so quickly, I'm not even sure how it could be protected. Do you have any advice on that?
I'd be very careful if considering about applying for a patent, because it's very difficult for a start to get a patent in areas such as software and applications. But also, and this is true of any patent application in any field, it's not just software and applications, but the patent process itself requires disclosure of the invention, the details of the patent. And so if you're business, if you're very keen that the details of your software or the underlying code or the application are kept relatively confidential, then I would suggest that a patent application is not the best step. And also, in today's fast-moving environment, it's likely that by the time the patent's registered, you've moved on, developed, evolved the initial work, and actually your original software or application that you were seeking the protection for is actually defunct. So my view is it's unlikely to be particularly relevant and is not essential.
Well, that's very good advice indeed. So that's Neil Mooring, who's a partner at Eversheds at London. Thank you very much, Neil.
Thank you.
Actually, it's really interesting, Dan, about copyright and protecting your trademarks as well. I think a lot of tech companies really need to look at advice around that because it's really important. So anyway, great information there from Sue Nelson and from Eversheds, which is great. And I know that there's further information on their website around stuff like that as well. So it's really important.
Well worth a look.
Yeah, and we're now joined by Kenny on the phone. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
I'm really good, thank you. And Kenny's from Homeshift. And Homeshift, actually, I've been on your website, Kenny, earlier. I thought it was actually really good. A great product. Tell us a little bit about what Homeshift does.
Yeah, of course. So Homeshift really is all about how we give consumers visibility over their household services. So to make it, I guess, contextual, as a consumer, typically the way that you're managing your bills are perhaps a pile of paperwork, or you're occasionally going online and looking at portals. You've got a real apathy around that. So what we do is we look to aggregate your household services into one place and provide a tech solution that essentially looks after those services for you, so that you as a consumer know that you're not paying over the odds for the services that you have in your house. And I guess our mission is really to deal with the sort of 70% of consumers who are paying what is too much for their services and then don't really have a good degree of what their consumption looks like, what they're getting for the money that they're paying. So it can be, that's what we're about.
Yeah, because for me, I mean, you know, I'm a homeowner, and sometimes it can be really hard to work out, actually, what am I really paying for that service and actually seeing what it's costing you. Do you find that as well, Kenny? Do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, we arrived at this solution because it's a pain point that we all felt that we had. We're quite a young team. Like, it seems a lot of technology businesses are these days. They're sort of looking to solve problems which we feel that we have as a team. We're apathetic as a young sort of professional. We don't have the time to be rummaging through bills and trying to work out what tariff information means and whether you're paying too much for your mortgage. And you know, I think that's pretty transferable to a lot of people out there. So,
explain to me what areas you actually cover. So it's not just, it's mortgage?
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately our goal is to cover all your key household services. So things like your energy, your internet, your home insurance, your mortgage information, and even things that we can't necessarily help you get a better price on, but we can give you a sense that you're paying the right price for, such as council tax and water. So yeah, it's really about giving you a holistic view on your household.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. So Homeshift sort of shows areas where customers can save money. Which areas do you think sort of movers can either save the most money or even save the most stress in the move?
Yeah, so I mean, you mentioned moving. That is one part of what we do. We help people who are moving into a new property to set up their homes. And essentially, what you find when most people move into a property is they end up being put onto what are the incumbent suppliers, so the providers that are already there. Mm-hmm. So take, for example, something such as energy. You move into a new property, you see on your doorstep, or your new doorstep, which you're obviously very happy with, that British Gas provides that supply. Mm-hmm. Your natural reaction is to pick up the phone and to tell British Gas that you've moved into the property. Now, as a result of doing that, you would, on average, be spending what is between £200 and £400 more for your energy, purely because you've called up the existing supplier and been put onto what is a standard tariff. And there are a host of things across, whether it's your insurance or your mortgage, where a sort of apathy around these services means that you're often not getting what is value for your money. Mm. So we're really looking to try and, you know, make sure that consumers aren't suffering that.
And that happened to me because I registered for electricity with a company, and they said, oh, sorry, but it was EDF. I will mention them by name. And they said, oh, we'll have to put you on our standard rate because we don't, there's something wrong with the computer or whatever. And of course, apathy reigns, doesn't it? I haven't phoned them back to say, can you change me to your discount rate or this rate or anything else? And actually, I'm still stuck on their standard rate. So what would I do with your... Is it a web portal that I go to, Kenny?
Yeah, it's a web portal. Looking at building an app as quickly as possible. Yeah. Like every startup, there's a journey to take there.
Yeah.
And all you really would do is you'd go onto our platform, you'd set up your household services, and we would look to then help you improve on on what you're spending and give you visibility on how those household services have been used by you. So, yeah, fairly straightforward.
And what areas are you seeing the biggest savings for your customers in? Is it in one particular area, or is it across the broad range of utilities and other services?
Well, from our end, we're probably maturest when it comes to things like energy. Like I said, from a sort of startup perspective, we're building out a lot of the functionality. So short term, it's very much been things like energy and the key services you set up when you move into the house. But longer term, we think there's a lot of value to be added to consumers around some of their key financial services. So things like their home insurance and even their mortgage.
And obviously, I was looking at internet the other day as well, and there does seem to be a growing move to actually remove line rental fees and things like that to actually make it more economic. Are you seeing that in the market as well?
Yeah, so the government's doing quite a bit of, I guess, regulatory work on how they open up that market for consumers. Typically, when someone signs up for an internet service, they're often locked in and have to pay penalty fees when they want to get out of the contract.
Yeah, yeah.
The government's really looking to try and strip away a lot of that, because obviously with more competition in the market and consumers having greater ease to change providers, it means that consumers get better value. So yeah, that is a growing trend. You're absolutely right. And I think that will increase over the next couple of years, definitely.
Interesting, yeah. So Kenny, I understand, if our researchers have done their job correctly, that you originally sort of studied university at the University of Northern Denmark. So how did you go from studying law in sort of Denmark and then ending up in Britain helping Brits move home, and save some money?
So your researchers haven't done their job properly.
Okay.
I'll laugh at that. I did study law, but not in Denmark.
In terms of
how did I go from law to, I guess, helping consumers? I mean, it's been a bit of a long journey, really. In the sense that I myself personally went through an experience where I was buying a property, and I think for anybody who's been through that experience, it's incredibly painful. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you'd agree with that. And myself and my co-founder, we had a hypothesis around how we could help what our consumers when they're going through that property transaction process. And we set about building a product to solve some of the key issues that we felt were in that process. And as part of building that product, we soon realized the real value that we were helping consumers with was the process of setting up their home. That's where we were getting the most traction with consumers. That's where consumers were seeming to give us the best feedback. And I guess like any good startup, you often zero in on where you think you can add value, and you strip away other things that you initially thought you could do. And that's kind of where our journey has been. It's been a very iterative one, whereby we saw that setting up homes was certainly something that would add value to consumers during a very painful process of moving. I think it's up there as one of the most stressful things in life. And then realizing that actually, away from just setting up their homes, being able to deliver them value while they're in their home on an ongoing basis with technology is something that I think myself and the team felt quite strongly about. And we're now very much on that journey and optimistic about where we're going, really. So. Yeah, that's kind of how we got there.
So we have a lot of new businesses listening into the show. What advice would you give people that are perhaps thinking about setting up their own business around tech? What have you learned, in terms of perhaps a key area that you need to consider?
I think the lesson that most entrepreneurs will probably say is that often your first idea is not what you're going to arrive at, and it's likely, if it's tech specific, it's likely not going to be the product that ends up being successful. So I think the best piece of advice for any entrepreneur is really about resilience and knowing that it's a long journey.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's a long journey and almost sniff out a market. Often we just sort of talked about my journey here, and I think if we'd have stayed in the road that we were, then we wouldn't be as far as we are now. So I think the very best entrepreneurs, they're able to adapt and they have almost an instinct to get where they need to get to.
And you never know where your market is going to open up for you. I think that's a key issue, I think, for a lot of entrepreneurs. They have the idea, they understand the technology. It's actually where it goes or where it's applied in which market. Yeah, I think that's
absolutely
really important. Yeah,
keep being open-minded about that as well, I think, is quite important because,
many
stories.
The normal thing, Kenny, is where do people get more information about Home Shift?
Yeah, so if they just go online, type in homeshift.com, then they can check out what we do online. Of course, they can also contact our team or contact us via email or on the website itself, and we'd be more than happy to tell them more about what we're doing and what journey we're on. So, go online.
Brilliant. Okay. It's been so great to talk to you. And as I say, I was really impressed with the website and how it actually could help people save money.
When we move next, I think I'm going to look at this. Definitely.
Yeah, I will too, Dan, actually. Yeah. So, Kenny, great. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Pleasure,
cheers,
guys.
Thank you.
Good to speak to you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You too. Bye.
That was good, Dan, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah.
Moving home is such a bad process.
It's painful, isn't it?
It is painful, yeah.
And it just never seems to end, does it?
No. And
there's always stuff in boxes and you've always got to arrange something else.
Yeah. But it is more about arranging something else. There's a long list.
That's the stuff that gets left behind, isn't it?
I mean, it'd be great to have a relocation company that did it all for you. I suppose you'd have Carruthers.
Oh, well,
would help.
I'll have
you.
My Batman to do
your
that.
Your Batman
sort of thing.
Would
yes,
do that
exactly.
for you, wouldn't he?
So, he organises these things, you know.
He helps you out. So, yeah. I think we're just going to finish off with a couple of little bits of news. We had to get this one on the show.
I just love the alliteration of this. So we've seen in recent times, so with smart devices, smart devices within the home, we've seen Amazon's Echo and Google's Home devices. Well, there's a Chinese company called Beijing Linglong who have developed their own one for the Chinese market called the Ding Dong.
So it's the Linglong Ding Dong.
Yeah,
is that
Ding
right?
Ding Dong by Linglong. Yep.
Yeah.
And that's just wonderful. If you like sort of words and alliteration and things like that, it's just wonderful to say. It's available, uses Mandarin and Cantonese, but does understand some basic and apparently has some tutorials on there for children. But it will control the usual sort of thing, a light switches, thermostats, home appliances, and will help with searches and directions, and very similar to the Google's and Amazon's offerings.
Yeah.
But just amazing name.
It's a completely new market, that, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy, yeah.
It's that personal assistant device type. I suppose it's taking what you've got on your phone and applying it to a more fixed location, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose, but just having all of your devices in your home being able to communicate with each other, and I find it a bit worrying, and that's where they say a lot of hacking sort of comes from, isn't it? These internet aware devices or internet available devices, but they don't have much in the way of security. But
I suppose the more roots into you, the harder it is to stay secure. Actually,
I suppose that's why we have those endoscopes, I suppose.
Yeah, just have a little root out. Yeah. Who's watching me? Yeah. Big Brother could be watching
you. Yeah.
Anyway, great show, Dan. Thanks for joining me, and we've had a great time.
It's always a pleasure, Steve.
Some good guests, and I think we're looking forward to next week already.
Yep, and I'm off to shoot one of the researchers.
Okay, yeah, you got that wrong.
Yeah.